All right, everybody, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Philip Drew, Administrator. Our next guest is James Bovard. He's a journalist and columnist who writes for the Future of Freedom Foundation, the Foundation for Economic Education, and many newspapers and magazines. He is also the author of 6 books, America's Unfairest Taxes, Tariffs, and Quotas, The Fair Trade Fraud, Lost Rights, The Destruction of American Liberty, for which he won a Mencken Award from the Free Press Association, Shakedown, How the State Screws You from A to Z, Freedom in Chains, The Rise of the State and the Demise of the Citizen, Feeling Your Pain, The Explosion and Abuse of Power under Clinton and Gore, and his latest is Terrorism and Tyranny, Trampling Freedom, Justice, and Peace to Rid the World of Evil. The Wall Street Journal calls him the roving inspector general of the modern state. Welcome to the show, Mr. Bovard.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Well, I guess the big news today is that Operation Red Dawn was a success and that Saddam Hussein has finally been captured in Iraq.
Well, yeah, and now it's time to bring our troops home.
I know, that's just what I was thinking. Was he was really the last excuse for us still having our guys over there, that he might come back to power.
Yeah, so, you know, I'm just looking forward to the Bush announcing the pullbacks, and hopefully we can have all the troops home by Christmas.
Yeah, I mean, especially since he was organizing all the resistance against us.
He was a very evil fellow, Saddam Hussein. He was a very bad guy. It's going to be fascinating to see how this plays out, and I hope that they have a public trial for him, and I'll be interested to see what he has to say for himself.
Well, he'll say that he was a Stalinist dictator who got what was coming to him from his former employers.
It will be most interesting, but it's going to be fascinating to see how this plays out, and, I hope that, let's see how it all plays out. It's going to be interesting to see how it spins.
Maybe it's silly of me, but what do you make of all the communist references in this war? I mean, Bush gave his triumphant speech on May Day, and now they're calling this Operation Red Dawn. I mean, is there some sort of subtle message I'm supposed to be getting here that I'm not?
Well, I guess they have to call it something now, don't they? I mean, I don't know what they're up to. I mean, it goes back to, it's the same with the idea of Axis of Evil. I mean, there was heavy propaganda element to that term. This is how politicians sell wars. I mean, it's tawdry, but, so is politics. So it's just unfortunate that this administration has not been more honest with the American people.
Okay, well, in your book, Terrorism and Tyranny, I have to admit to you, I haven't read the book, but I've read as much about it as I can on the internet and so forth. And apparently you begin the book really with going back in time to the first war on terrorism under Ronald Reagan and that kind of thing. So I was hoping that maybe we can just sort of walk us through the book and, or at least as a starting point, explain the first war on terrorism back in the 80s.
Well, Ronald Reagan war on terrorism was a very high priority when he came into office. And he often talked about how he and his Secretary of State Alexander Haig talked about how the Soviets were behind the terrorist threat, and it turned out that very little the Soviets had very little to do with it, but it was a very nice way to build support for the war effort. What the Reagan administration did was blunder into the Middle East. Basically, they sent U.S. troops to Beirut after the Israeli invasion of Lebanon and after the massacres by the Christians at the Muslim the Palestinian refugee camps in September 1982. U.S. troops were stationed there. U.S. Marines were in a very poorly defended situation. The U.S. Navy started bombarding the Navy, the Muslim forces there in the Beirut area, and the Muslims launched a suicide attack against the U.S. troops. Hundreds of American soldiers died, and it didn't get any prettier after that, and shortly thereafter, U.S. troops were pulled out, but the U.S. continued meddling in the Middle East and spurring other terrorist attacks and things like that on the U.S. U.S. forces and U.S. citizens over there.
Pardon me for a second, but in Bob Woodward's book, Veil, he says that that truck bombing was actually revenge for a truck bombing that the CIA had done only a few weeks before in trying to kill, I think, the president of Lebanon's brother. That it missed its target but killed a bunch of people. It was a truck bombing, and then their truck bombing was the revenge for ours first.
Well, the CIA did apparently have some involvement in a car bomb that exploded outside of a Muslim cleric's house in, I believe, March or April 1985. That was about a year and a half after the suicide attack on the U.S. force, U.S. Marines. There were other suicide attacks on U.S. embassies there.
You can't trust Bob Woodward to get his story straight.
Well, there's a lot of very interesting stuff which he has which he's done in his work on the CIA during the Reagan administration. There were a number of assassinations and counter-assassinations throughout that period. It was just basically a total mess. So it was unfortunate that the Reagan administration thought that the U.S. would be able somehow go in there and make it and, turn it all into a fairy tale that has a happy ending.
Well, so when he pulled our troops out after they got bombed in Beirut, I guess the anti-war people hail this as common sense by the president that, hey, you know, we just have no business there and we need to get out. And yet the war hawks say, aha, pulling our troops out of Beirut only emboldened them and showed them that we're weak and that we'll turn around with only a few casualties, and that this really made matters worse.
Well, I mean, there was not that much attention at the time that Reagan pulled the troops out, I believe in early 1984, and the U.S. government continued its massive involvement in the Middle East, you know, throughout the Reagan administration, and things really did not get any prettier. There were a lot of other debacles and disasters along the way, such as the U.S. Selling arms to the Iranian government at a time when the U.S. government insisted the Iranian government was terrorist. There were all kinds of jigglings, and it's fascinating that the history of that period has been rewritten as the history of a lot of things have been back then to try and make Ronald Reagan a perfect hero and a saint. There were some very good things that Reagan did, and some of his rhetoric was right on, but Reagan's war on terrorism was a debacle.
Well, and it was during this whole time that he was creating the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, right?
That was a factor, yeah. We were building them up to counteract the Soviets, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. So it's kind of, you know, it was a mess, as these things usually are. I mean, that's what foreign policy is for.
Yeah. Well, and actually, you know, that's a really good point in itself right there. I mean, is that the case, that foreign policy is for making a disaster so that they have another disaster to clean up for next time?
Well, I would not assume that's intentional. I mean, you know, many of these blunders, people just going into them blind and don't really have any idea what's going on. It's often a thing about arrogance, and we've seen that with the war in Iraq. We've seen that in many other foreign debacles over the decades.
I guess the war on terrorism sort of took a hiatus during the Bush years. I can't think of anything big going on there, the first Bush 41, they call them.
There was not as much happening then. Things heated up a little bit with Clinton. Shortly after Clinton took office, there was the first World Trade Center bombing, done by a cadre of Muslims in the New York area who had an FBI informant right in the middle of them. And the FBI informant had offered to substitute an inert ingredient instead of the bomb, but the FBI told him not to. So a very curious, thing there. And, the FBI informant afterwards said that he could have stopped the bombing, but that the FBI did not encourage him to do so. Does raise questions.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because I was going to, and I wasn't sure if you would want to go with that or not. But, in fact, for anybody who's interested, I remember off the top of my head, in fact, it's the October 28th, 1993 New York Times on the front page there has a whole thing about, really, wasn't it the cop inside the group who actually made the bomb? I mean, wasn't this a terrorist group that didn't even have anyone with bomb-making skills except the informant?
Well, according to the informant's statements, he was one that taught them a lot about making bombs. I mean, I don't know, you know, it's hard to know how much it trusts the informant. So, but there is a, it's very, very strange to see the level of FBI involvement with the group that that made the first attack on the World Trade Center, and yet the FBI did not have any culpability for it afterwards. So it's just surprising that they didn't, that it never really came through. So that the FBI dodged all penalties for that when they should have, you know, when Congress should have done a very thorough investigation, but they didn't. So typical.
So this group that bombed the World Trade Center in 1993, Ramzi Youssef and Omar Abdel Rahman and all those guys, are they? They're tied with the Bin Laden group. What became Al Qaeda, or? Are they?
I don't know. You know. There's a lot of different allegations on that, and I really have not seen a good, clean answer on that. So, it's really hard to tell. There's been a number of smoke screens and counter smoke screens put out on that first group. But the thing that just fascinated me was to see the government's level of involvement, the FBI's level of involvement in the. Before the attack, and the FBI still failed to block the attack.
All right, we might as well bring up Oklahoma City, too, because there are lots of reports from varied sources in the Philippines that said that Terry Nichols was there training in bomb-making school with Ramzi Youssef after he had escaped after the 93 World Trade Center bombing, right?
I've heard of those reports. I don't know if they have any credibility. Perhaps they do, and I just don't know it. I mean, it's not something which I've investigated. I've read a fair amount about the Oklahoma City bombing, but it's frustrating the government is not been more open, shall we say, as far as the details surrounding that attack.
Okay, I'll let you off the hook with that one then.
Well, you don't need to let me off the hook. I mean, feel free to pursue it if you want. So,
well, I don't remember the names off the top of my head of the people, but I believe that the story was that Ramzi Youssef, when they were doing the plot that they called Bojinka, which means loud bang in I don't know what language, in the Philippines in 1995, before they got arrested for the first World Trade Center bombing, and that apparently there were the former head of the Philippine ISI, I think they called it, their secret police there, said that Terry Nichols was there, that they called him the farmer, and that he was there taking bomb-making class with that being taught by Ramzi Youssef. But anyway, like you said, I wasn't there either. I don't know. I was hoping maybe you knew a little bit more about it than I do.
Well, I have heard those statements made. I'm just a little skeptical of it's not something which I've investigated, and I really can't say if there's anything accurate on that, so.
Okay, now, well, let me ask you this then. Do you accept the Clinton administration's assertions that the bombings in Kenya and Tanzania in, 1998, that those were the work of Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden?
My impression is that is correct. Based partly on Bin Laden or other people with Al Qaeda, I believe, claim credit for it shortly afterwards, which is often a clue in these things. I think it was shortly after Bin Laden had issued a fatwa, or however the hell it's called, a fatwa against the U.S. So, I mean, that would be, it would seem, certainly plausible or probable. I mean, based on what I've seen. So,
okay. And then, as revenge for that, he bombed an antibiotics factory and an empty mountainside in Afghanistan, making Bin Laden a hero. Basically,
you're talking about President Clinton now.
Yeah.
Yes. Yep. I've got a lot of discussion about the bombing of the pharmaceutical factory in the book. There's a lot of stuff. That's one of the tawdriest episodes of the Clinton administration's war on terrorism. the hitting of that factory. And, you know, I mean, that was one of the largest pharmaceutical factories in Africa.
Well, and the neocons, when they like to dismiss Bill Clinton, they say, oh, he bombed an aspirin factory. But in fact, that factory made real medicine for people, right? Not just aspirin.
You got it. You got it. Yeah, it was a complete mess, and the U.S. government was profoundly dishonest on that. But that's, you know, that's foreign policy, so.
Well, and was it before or after that that Sudan tried to give up bin Laden and every bit of intelligence they had on his group?
My understanding was that the government of Sudan had made such offers both before and after, that the government, you know, bent over backwards trying to, to offer U.S. Information to the U.S. government, and the U.S. government spurned their offers.
Do we have any idea, or do you have any idea why Bill Clinton?
Oh, you know, it's hard to understand entirely, and some of the main players really have not opened up yet, so we might know a little bit later on, but it's, I don't know. I mean, part of it is there's some huge egos there. There was a lot of hostility towards the government of Sudan because of the very brutal policies. But I don't know. It was a mess. It was a mess. One among many.
I'm a Clinton hater as good as the rest of them, and
but go ahead.
It's easy for me to assume that. Oh, well, he just doesn't care or whatever, but no, I mean, come on. This is the President of the United States. They're offering to turn over Osama bin Laden. There's got to be some reason that he weighed against arresting this guy. I mean...
Well, okay, but keep in mind that, you know, President Clinton may not have been involved in that decision. It may have been handled by the FBI, Janet Reno, the State Department. So, if memory serves, there were some folks who were concerned that the U.S. government did not have enough evidence to press charges against bin Laden at that point, and that may have been part of the reason why he was why they turned down the offer from Sudan. There's a lot of strange things here, a lot of fishy things.
All right, well, and I guess to get up to speed. After nothing happened in the 90s, basically impotent war on terrorism fought by the Clinton administration, September 11th happened, and that got everything that's going right now.
I would not say that there was an impotent war on terrorism in the 1990s. There were a few things. They had a few successes. There was a guy coming in from Canada close to Seattle who was planning to blow up LAX, and he was stopped. But a major problem was that the Clinton... It started with Bush 1, and then Clinton maintained the station of U.S. troops in Saudi Arabia, which turned out to be a profound source of hostility among fundamentalist Muslims. And it did not add anything to our national security, but it just created immense hostility in large parts of the globe.
Well, yeah, and it's probably telling that all the hijackers were from countries that are friendly to us, not from the Iran or Iraq or the countries that we didn't control.
Well, I don't know if I'd say that Yemen was a friendly country. I think one or two were from Yemen, maybe not. I don't recall exactly, but
that assumes you can believe their list of hijackers anyway. I mean, six or seven of them claim to still be alive in Saudi Arabia, that they weren't on those planes at all, for all we know.
Well, I've heard that allegation. Again, I've not pursued it, so.
Well, but anyway, the vast majority of the guys on the planes were from Saudi Arabia and from Egypt. They weren't Iraqis or Iranians or...
Right. Yeah, I'd say that the government of Egypt is friendly towards us. I don't know if the people of Egypt are friendly towards us, so. And the same with the Saudis. I mean, I think there's a lot of animosity there among those peoples because of our foreign policies.
You mean it's not just because they hate us because we're free and rich?
Well, something like that. Yeah, I mean, there's lots of rich people in the Middle East, and I don't think that's a source of hatred, so.
No. Okay, well, I'll try to ask broader questions and give you time to go ahead and answer and say what's on your mind here. You got books full of it, so.
That's true. There's a lot of information in the book. I kind of hate to do, well, yeah, fire away.
Well, go ahead, man. Plug your book if you want.
No. Go ahead with your questions. Go ahead.
All right. I know what I'll get you on here. September 11th failures. I watched your interview with, what's his name from C-SPAN on Book Notes?
Brian Lamb,
that's his name. And the question was about the August 6th briefing that George Bush got about hijackings and massive al-Qaeda attacks from I believe, August 6th, 2001, about a little bit more than a month before the September 11th attack. And apparently there's been some in the news lately about between the negotiations between the White House and the September 11th Commission and how they decided they would let them look at, I guess, still redacted copies of the president's brief, and that they would only show it to people at the top. And I wonder if you have any opinion on what they're hiding there. Why such secrecy about September 11th?
That's a very good question. I don't know what they're up to. I mean, it's very strange that the Bush administration is insisting on all the secrecy for things that have often not been considered secret before. I mean, it's not like the presidential daily brief is going to have any information on the methods or sources of intelligence information. It's just a simple summary. And Bush and Condi Rice and others were very emphatic after 9/11 that the administration had no warning of this type of attack. But we know that there was some specific warning that al-Qaeda planned to do an attack in the U.S. and that August 6, 2001 briefing. So I don't know what they're hiding in it. It certainly does not inspire confidence that, you know, there was a vacancy recently in the 9/11 Commission, and instead of putting someone on there like Kristen Breitwiser, who's a widow and a guy that died in the World Trade Center, and has also been a very intelligent and sharp critic and activist trying to find out the truth, George Bush did not put her in the 9/11 panel. Instead, Bush put former Senator Bob Kerry, whose record in Vietnam does not exactly inspire confidence that he would dig into a possible government misconduct.
Oh, yeah, wasn't Bob Kerry, isn't he the guy who was part of a big My Lai-type massacre down there?
Well, I don't know about the My Lai-type massacre, I mean, but from some of the things which have come out, on some of the allegations, I mean, it's certainly not something which you would want to campaign for president on, let's put it like that, and that may have some of those revelations may have impacted Senator Kerry's decision not to pursue higher office. For some reason, I mean, well, it wasn't a problem for the Bush administration. Let's put it like that.
Well, and this September 11th commission is going to end up just producing a sham of a report anyway. I mean, they're not getting access to what they need from the administration. Their time's going to be up.
You know, it's hard to tell what's going to be in the final report. It's possible that it's going to be better than what you or I expect. I mean, there have been a lot of frustrations. It's amazing. I think it was the Federal Aviation Administration which they issued subpoenas to. There's a lot of strange stuff going on here. And yet, even with that, it is possible that there would be some very good information that came out of this out of this commission. I mean, in the same way that the House and Senate Intelligence Committees dragged on their hearings for months and months, and I think a lot of people expected they'd have little or nothing in their report, but there was actually a great deal of very good material in that Joint Intelligence Committee report on pre-9/11 failures.
Well, yeah, it was pretty limited in scope, though, too, wasn't it?
Well, it was limited in scope, but if folks would look at the report, there was a great deal there to undermine the blind faith, to undermine the whitewash that the Bush administration attempted to do of almost the entire federal government regarding 9/11. There was a lot of good information there on FBI failures, on CIA failures, on the failure to coordinate. there was some good stuff there. So, I mean, it's something which I quote heavily in the book, so.
Okay, let's talk about the Patriot Act. Right after September 11th, I guess a month later, they passed the Patriot Act. And this caused all kinds of consternation all across the country. Hundreds of cities have passed resolutions against it and that kind of thing. John Ashcroft has felt compelled to go around the country giving speeches to police about why it's a good thing.
John Ashcroft's Patriot Act Salvation Tour.
Yeah, well, is that what they call it?
Sure, his Patriot Act Salvation Tour.
So,
didn't work, but I'm sure he enjoyed the traveling nonetheless.
Yeah, well, it's not like he had to pay for it.
That's right.
And I'm sure he was still flying a private jet like he started doing before September 11th.
Yeah, curious things, aren't they? It's interesting how the Patriot Act has become more controversial. It's good that people have paid more attention to it. It was unfortunate that the Bush administration and Ashcroft managed to ram that through Congress, even before members of the House had time to read it before voting on it the first time around. There are so many things, there was so much demagoguing and browbeating that was done to get that act pushed through Congress before it could be seriously considered. And yet, Ashcroft in his speeches of the Patriot Act talks about the voting margin in the House and Senate which approved that bill, almost as if that proves it's a good bill. But actually, that's simply a measure of the intimidation that was used on some congressmen.
Okay, so since the Patriot Act, there's a few new classifications of people being held by the federal government, and I wonder if maybe you can help clear them up. I know there's detainees, which I think are still being held by the Justice Department, along with material witnesses that they're still holding on to. And then, of course, there's the enemy combatants that have been turned over to the Navy. So maybe you can help explain exactly how they're using this Patriot Act. Who are these detainees and material witnesses? And
well, most of this stuff is not tied directly to the Patriot Act. I mean, the thing about people who are material witnesses, this is a much the administration's the Justice Department's policies on that are much, much broader than what was prior to 9/11. I don't know that there's something, I don't know that's a result of the Patriot Act. I don't recall there being anything in the Patriot Act about material witness changing the category. As far as the concept of enemy combatant, there again, that's not, I don't believe there's anything in the Patriot Act about that, but that's something that's more was a Pentagon creation, which has been barred by the Justice Department for some cases here in the U.S., such as the Jose Padilla case. But there's certainly more than enough mischief to go around in the Patriot Act. So,
well, like what?
Well, it makes it much easier for the government to confiscate people's property when they're traveling. If a person fails to fill out a form notifying the government they're taking more than $10,000 in cash in or out of the country, the government can seize all their money and send them to prison. And this is a policy which was struck down by the Supreme Court 3 years earlier in a decision written by Clarence Thomas, but the Justice Department took the opportunity of 9/11 to get that put back on the books.
Oh, cool. I didn't know that Congress could just override a Supreme Court decision.
Well,
it's nice to know there's some checks and balances up there still.
Well, I think that's something which most high school civics classes forgot to mention. But that is how things are working these days. And it was very brazen, but this is how they did it. And there's really, it's almost completely unchecked power, so. But that is, there are a lot of things in the, it'll be interesting 2 or 3 years from now to see how many provisions of the Patriot Act have been struck down as unconstitutional, because my guess is the clock is ticking on a number of those provisions.
Well, I hope you're right about that, although the Supreme Court just upheld making it illegal to run TV ads 3 days
ago. Oh, God, yeah, okay, good point. I mean, yeah, I was astounded that the Supreme Court upheld the ban on issue ads by private groups.
Yeah, I mean, they even said when they passed it, well, yeah, we passed it, but don't worry, the Supreme Court will overthrow the bad parts of it. And
yeah, and it's just, I mean, it's just, well, George Bush, at the time he signed the bill, made some kind of comment that he thought parts of it were unconstitutional, but the Supreme Court would take care of that, which you know, adds some insight into what Bush considers his oath of office to mean, because Bush took an oath to uphold the Constitution, but I guess that doesn't matter if he's signing an act of law, so... it is a wild card. What the Supreme Court would do or not do. Now, I mean, I think on some of the issues of the Patriot Act, the liberals would all vote against it. But then again, maybe not. I mean, these are wild cards. So I have no idea which way they're going these days.
Well, yeah, and you know, it's the hardcore right. People like Bob Barr has even been coming out criticizing it, and I know he voted for the Patriot Act in the first place.
Well, Barr did vote for the Patriot Act, but Barr made some very good criticisms before the act passed, and I think he was working to try to get it mollified a little bit. And he's made very good comments after the act passed. I mean, he just really voted for it, and that's very puzzling, but Barr has done some very good writing on the Patriot Act and Justice Department abuses per se. I mean, Barr was probably the most savvy member of the House as far as government surveillance issues.
Yeah, there's some great clips of him from the Waco hearings.
Oh, he was magnificent in those hearings. I mean, you know, it's kind of frustrating that Barr is no longer in Congress because he was one of the few people who could really, you know, could intensely pay attention and take apart a witness. I mean, a witness that was lying. And so few of the members of the Congress, especially in the House, I mean, if you watch them at the hearings, you know, they have 5 minutes each, and, you know, they just sit there and gas bag and and you're wondering, you know, Jesus. I mean, it is as if they don't even try to find out what the truth is. I mean, Barr is a very sharp fellow. He had excellent concentration, but that is so rare on Capitol Hill, even among people with good values. I mean, another person that can do that is Ron Paul. Ron Paul is superb. I've seen him do some great work in hearings as well, but very, very few.
Yeah, he's great to watch when Alan Greenspan's testifying before the House Banking Committee. That's always a hoot.
Oh, it's always good to see him turn up the heat.
All right, let me ask you about, you know, I'm sure there are lots of paranoid fantasies about just how bad it was going to be after September 11th. And I wonder if the Department of Homeland Security and what they call NORCOM, which is, I guess, the new military command for the continental United States, to what degree are they really consolidating federal police power over state and local agencies? And to what extent is it mostly just a bunch of hype, or is there really a massive, profoundly unconstitutional consolidation of police power going on here? Or,
you know, I don't know if the problem is primarily in the consolidation, but just some of the new doctrines that they're trying to flourish, such as carnivore. The Patriot Act sanctified the use of carnivore, and which is makes it very easy for the FBI to vacuum up massive amounts of email without a search warrant. There are all kinds of, but it's hard to know how much the government's doing, because, you know, the government's been very secretive and has been very, it's hard to know what's going on, so.
So we really don't know then to what degree for example, NORCOM, this is the thing that kind of really gets me, is the idea that the military is really going to be participating with federal and state police.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is something which we've had with the drug war, and it certainly worked out wonderfully. It's a reason why the U.S. won the drug war, I guess. There have been a lot of profound abuses when the U.S. military has been involved in law enforcement for anti-drug efforts. I expect that the military becomes involved in anti-terrorism stuff here in the U.S. Homeland, we'll see a lot of horrendous situations as well. I don't know. You know, it's kind of frustrating to think of the, it's a sign of the audacity of the Bush administration that the first that they would offer a total information awareness plan, and secondly, that the person they put in charge of it would be someone who had 5 felony convictions, which were overturned on appeal. But, I mean, still, John Poindexter was not the kind of man to inspire confidence, and yet the Bush folks were just thinking that people would roll over and accept it.
Yeah, it really shows a profound disconnect between, I mean, like the idea of putting Kissinger in charge of the September 11th commission. I mean, come on, we're watching here. I mean,
yeah,
you
know.
Think?
Yeah, there's a funny, you know, the Thanksgiving a year ago, I was visiting some folks and driving back up from the Shenandoah Valley, coming back to Washington. And Thanksgiving night, I stopped in the gas station. And I hadn't heard the news all day, and I was very encouraged because there was a big picture. There was a New York Times and it had a big picture of Ashcroft, a big picture of Kissinger right on the front top of the page. And I was encouraged because there had been a lot of talk by Christopher Hitchens and others lately about, before that, about how Kissinger might be indicted for war crimes. So I said, ah, maybe it's happened. But then I walked over and saw the print, and instead of being indicted for war crimes, Kissinger was nominated to be the head of the 9/11 Commission. And I said, damn, well, so much for getting my hopes up.
Yeah, it was funny. There was just a thing right before September 11th. There was a big thing on, I think it was on 60 Minutes, about his ordering of the assassination of the, I forget the general's name, in Chile, and how it organized.
I don't think it was a general. I think it was Allende, who
It was Allende. It was like their equivalent of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs or whatever.
Oh, really? Okay, fine. Well, it's not something which I'm familiar with, but...
But it was just describing how Kissinger was a terrorist. And how then 3 days later, September 11th happens, and he's the guest on Fox News to teach us all about terrorism.
Yeah, there was some other stuff, I believe, that came out in the last week or two about Kissinger in Argentina. These are not things I've studied closely, but, I mean, Kissinger has a lot of problems, let's just put that, as far as credibility problems. But Bush chose him and just figured people would roll over, so...
Well, maybe we are just rolling over. I mean,
well, some people are, some people aren't. But the thing that's encouraging is if only, 15 or 20% of the American public would pay attention and stand up on these things, the U.S., this kind of nonsense would be stopped. But it hasn't happened yet, so.
All right, well, I want to get back now to, well, I guess this goes kind of along the same question about the disconnect between reality and what's going on in the White House. I guess I'd like to give you an opportunity here. I've heard you talk about this, and I've read a few comments of yours here and there about really not just the war in Iraq being phony and unjust, the invasion of Iraq, but also that really the basis for the entire war on terrorism is faulty in itself. Can you expand on what you mean by that? Because I think most people, anti-Iraq war would still say, well, we got to go have the war on terrorism, but the Iraq war is a distraction from that.
Well, okay.
And I don't mean to put words in your mouth, but
right,
to clarify here.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, that's not quite what I said. What I've said is the U.S. government after 9/11 was obliged to go after Al-Qaeda and make sure they would never attack us again. And that's something which is vital for our national security and for American safety. But the whole thought of going, the thought of the idea that the U.S. is obliged to rid the world of terrorism is a whole different thing, and it turns into an unending war, and it's nonsense to assume that terrorists anywhere are enemies of the U.S., because that's not the case. Most terrorists don't have anything to do with the U.S. Bush talks about a global war on terrorism, and this is something which could easily be unending and just drag on forever, and it's not going to make us safe.
Well, so I didn't misquote you that bad.
Maybe I'm wrong.
Oh, I'm sorry, man.
No, it's fine. It's fine.
Well, I mean, I think that's a major point. I mean, if we're going to go after Al-Qaeda, then that's really sounds to me more like a police operation rather than a war on terror. I mean,
Yeah, well, and it's accurate, as you said, that the war in Iraq has nothing to do with Al-Qaeda. I mean, there's been profound dishonesty by the Bush administration on this. George Bush portrayed Saddam Hussein practically as a 20th hijacker on 9/11, and there was never any evidence to support that. And now, now it just keeps, and yet it's almost as if we're, as if the U.S. is supposed to forget all the false statements that Bush has made, both on Iraq and many other aspects of his war on terrorism. Something which I try to do in Terrorism and Theory is, it's got a couple thousand footnotes. I try to walk people through what government officials did and what the facts were to prove them wrong in case after case after case. And it's important to pay attention to Bush's speeches because there's a lot of very important stuff and a lot of dangerous stuff there. Some of the documents he's putting out are very subversive both of American safety and world peace.
In your book, you have a chapter called, or a section at least, I guess, called The Israeli Model for Fighting Terrorism. And I noticed that just in this last week, there was an article in the New Yorker by Seymour Hersh and another one in The Guardian about, not just figuratively, but literally, we're now using Israelis to help us train Iraqi death squads.
I haven't read the Seymour Hersh article. Hersh has done a lot of the best writing in the war on terrorism. He's done just superb stuff. It's very unfortunate that the U.S. is basically copying a failed model for its efforts in Iraq. Since Eric Sharon became Prime Minister of Israel, more Israelis have been killed by terrorist attacks than died in the Six-Day War in 1967. Ariel Sharon's approach to the terrorist problem, as he calls it, has been disastrous for Israelis, and it's absurd that the U.S. would be thinking that it's going to have more success in a huge country like Iraq than it does in small areas in Gaza Strip and the West Bank.
And so now we're using their model in Iraq, just surrounding houses with razor wire villages with razor wire and putting up checkpoints and collective punishment. We're going about our occupation of Iraq in much the same way that the Israeli army occupies the West Bank now.
Well, it's part of a secret strategy for winning hearts and minds. It's a policy relying on brute force. There's no reason to expect it's going to work. There's so much arrogance in some of these high government officials that they seem to think that the U.S. is so powerful it can do whatever it pleases and just crush any opposition. It's not going to work out that way. It's going to get more Americans killed, and it's not going to make it safer.
It actually kind of reminds me of Waco, where you have one group of people who are trying to negotiate with the Davidians, and another group of people who are just driving tanks around and waving guns in the air and acting like tough guys. And I guess, really the analogy could go to Paul Bremer is trying to negotiate, trying to set up a democracy, trying to, get along and fix infrastructure and get people to like and accept the Americans there. And at the same time, the army's going around killing everybody.
Well, I would not say the army's killing everybody. But
killing lots of people.
Well, yeah, there have been a lot of innocent people who have been killed, and there's been some very heavy-handed methods used by the U.S. forces there, which are counterproductive. I mean, it doesn't make any sense for us to be going in there with such a heavy hand and just breeding new generations of hatred there. This is what we're doing, and, I guess who knows how this is going to play out, but it's a lot uglier than what most Americans realize.
Well, we're almost out of time here, but I want to give you a chance. I never want to neglect the opportunity on my show to get in some good Woodrow Wilson bashing. And I noticed that, I think it was your last column that you wrote for the Future Freedom Foundation, was a pretty good comparison of Woodrow Wilson and George Bush. So I figure I'll give you an opportunity to talk bad about old Woodrow if you'd like to.
Well, I'm always happy to have the opportunity to kick some dirt on Woodrow Wilson, even though he was born in my home state of Virginia. There's a wonderful new book which you've probably talked about here by Thomas Fleming, The Illusion of Victory, which does a wonderful job of walking people through the lies which the U.S. government told to help drag the U.S. into the First World War. The lies that occurred during the war, when far more Americans died than there should have, than would have been necessary to die for any good reason, and the lies told after the war, when, you know, when the Wilson administration completely lost control of the peace process and ended up destroying its credibility. There are so many parallels for our current times. I mean, this is a book that people should read, and Thomas Fleming's book, and just constantly keep in mind what the government did then and what the government's doing now.
Yeah, exporting democracy.
With bombs and missiles and everything else. And, you know, it didn't work then, and it didn't, it's not going to work. I mean, it's very unlikely to work now, and it's creating new hatreds. And you know, the Second World War was born out of the failures and follies of the First World War and the peace settlement from there. So, and yet people are supposed to think, well, but you know, but we had good intentions. Well, if people are lying, it doesn't matter if they claim good intentions or not.
Well, on a different topic here, and I suppose the last one, as I'm running out of things here. There's been a big debate in libertarian circles about Neil Bortz giving a speech at the Libertarian Convention in May in Atlanta, and your name has been floated a bit here and there about perhaps debating him. And so I wonder whether anybody had asked you about that already, or whether you thought that was a good idea or not.
I've not been asked by anybody in the LP about debating Bortz.
Okay, because I saw your name here and there in some of the email lists, but I wasn't
good
sure.
Good old Carol Moore. Carol Moore's putting that name out there and promoting that. So Carol's a very nice lady.
Hey, she wrote a great book about Waco, by the way, too.
And I think it's still, the first edition had blurred for me on the cover, I think. Maybe it didn't. I don't know if it had on the cover or not. But, no, I mean, she wrote a fine book on Waco, very factual, very detailed. There's so many things which Carol noticed that other people did not notice or other people forgot. But Carol was dogging on that issue from day one and just kind of pulled so much good stuff together for her book. It is still worth reading to help get a handle on Waco.
Right, and that's the Davidian Massacre by Carol Moore.
Yep.
All right, last question here, Mr. Bovar. Do you think there's any hope of having constitutional government again? I mean, really, if it comes to violence to restore liberty, that might just make everything worse.
I'm certainly not advocating violence to restore liberty here.
I didn't mean to imply that you were.
Sure,
that you were
right.
Advocating.
Okay. Fine. Okay. You know, it could happen. It could happen. I mean, you know, it's a question whether people start paying attention, and if people don't pay attention to the government, the government's going to get a lot worse fast, and that's the direction we're heading in.
All right, well, I guess that's sort of hopeful, at least. There was a maybe in there.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, it's Bovard-style optimism.
Great. All right, everybody. Jim Bovard. He is the author of Terrorism and Tyranny, Trampling Freedom, Justice, and Peace to Rid the World of Evil. You can read many columns by him at fff.org. That's the Future of Freedom Foundation. And
also www.jimbovard.com.
That's what I was about to say, jimbovard.com.
Oh, okay, sorry to interrupt.
Oh, no, that's all right with me. I don't mind. This
okay.
is Radio Chaos, after all. Well, thanks a lot for coming on the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
All right, take it easy.
You too.